The time is now. Volume 1, Episode 14. This is Employment Law Now, and I am Mike Schmidt, Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department at Cozen O'Connor. Thanks so much for listening and joining me today. I hope you all had a terrific Labor Day weekend. It's hard to believe that it is September and that the summer is over, but maybe we'll be able to enjoy some good weather wherever you are September continues. But I can't really ignore, obviously, the unbelievable pictures and sounds that I've been experiencing from the Houston area as we talk about the summer and the weather where you are. It truly is remarkable what we've been seeing and what we've been hearing from those folks who have been suffering such an unbelievable tragedy down there. I have co-workers here at Cozen O'Connor and friends who are down at Houston. I have friends who have friends and family down in Houston, so I hope and wish that everybody has nothing but positive as we move along and as things hopefully start to improve down there. But in our first segment to that end, we start with our Trending Now segment, and you realize that, of course, like everything else, beyond just the human tragedy aspect of it, there is an employment aspect to this as well. And I've been asked a whole lot of questions when it comes to certain obligations that employers may have with regard to their employees down in the Houston area. But this really applies not just to this Houston tragedy that we're dealing with now, but really to a hurricane or some other natural disaster that could be happening in any jurisdiction. You have to recognize, as I always say, that there are different states and different localities that may have different answers and requirements to these kinds of frequently asked questions. But here are some answers to the top five questions that I've been asked recently about the employment aspect involving this Houston tragedy. And I'm going to give you some of my general thoughts based on federal law. It's question number one. If your business is closed because of some natural disaster like this, or you can't reopen because of damage caused by the disaster, are you required to pay your employees? Well, the answer really depends on whether we're talking about non-exempt or exempt employees. For your non-exempt employees, those who are not exempt from the minimum wage and overtime requirements, say from the FLSA, the Federal Wage and Hour Statute, for those non-exempt individuals, you are only required to pay for the hours that they work. So if your business is closed because of some natural disaster, or you have been closed and you can't reopen, if they're not engaging in any work, you do not have to pay your non-exempt employees. There are a couple of exceptions to that, like there are with everything. If you have non-exempt employees who are still being paid a full salary or a fixed salary for fluctuating work weeks that they may work, you're still required to pay their full salary even if they don't work the entire week but do work for some portion of that work week. It's also important to keep in mind that some states have call-in pay requirements or reporting pay requirements if they show up for some portion of the day and they're sent back home, or if they are called in, they're calling in and they're told with less than X number of hours notice that they do not have to report to work. Some states, some local jurisdictions do contain reporting pay obligations in those situations. But again, the general rule is for non-exempt employees, you only have to pay for the hours that they actually work. When it comes to exempt employees, you are required to pay their full weekly salary if you're closed or if you're unable to reopen for less than a full work week. So stated another way, if the exempt employee has worked any portion of the particular work week, you have to pay him or her the salary as if they worked for that entire work week. Now, you certainly can require them to use some leave time if they've got leave time in the bank, but otherwise you cannot deduct from their salary if they work any portion of that week. If, however, your business is closed for the entire week or can't reopen for an entire week and the employee does not perform any work during that week, then you don't have to pay him for or pay her for that week. But do be careful, because in 2017, when telecommuting and remote access is so prevalent, again, any work being performed in that week will require, in most cases, the payment of the fixed salary for that entire week. Question number two, can you dock the salary from an exempt employee who does not return to work when needed? So if your business is able to reopen and the exempt employee still does not show up to work, do you have to pay that individual or can you dock the salary? Well, if the employer is open for business and the absence of the employee is caused, for example, by some transportation difficulties, the United States Department of Labor generally considers that to be a personal reason, in which case you as the employer can dock if the absence was for a full day for that personal reason, or you could also require them to use some approved leave. Again, the difference really is between full day absences and partial day absences. So to be clear again, if this is for a personal reason that the individual is absent due to transportation difficulty or something else that's considered a personal reason, and the absence was for a full day, then yes, the company can dock from the full day's pay of even the exempt employee. You cannot, however, dock for less than a full day absence. In other words, if the individual worked for some portion of the day. Question three, can I have my employees on call? We're not sure if we're going to have to close or we're not sure when we're going to be able to reopen. Can I have them on call? Well, the answer to that is yes, but you also have to be careful when it comes to the payment requirements there. You may be required, for example, to pay for the time that's being required to remain on call, particularly if the individual has to remain on call on the employer's premises, or if they have to remain close by to the premises and their comings and goings ability is significantly restricted. This is very much a creature of state and local law, so you want to check the requirements of your jurisdiction to make sure what your obligations will be when it comes to on-call time. Question four, what about the FMLA, Family Medical Leave Act? Does that come into play here? And the answer to that question is yes, it may. For example, if your employee or the immediate family member of one of your employees suffers a serious health condition that has to be taken care of, well, that individual employee may be entitled, if otherwise covered, may be entitled to take FMLA leave. So you want to consult with the FMLA requirements when it comes to somebody who may require leave for him or herself or for an immediate family member. And then finally, number five, and this has come up, although it may not be something that is a question that you would think of right away, but what if your employee is there at your facility or there in your office and can't leave the facility for some reason, weather-related or some natural disaster-related, and that individual continues to work? Do I have to pay him or her? I didn't schedule it. I didn't plan for him or her to be there at work, but they continue to do the work because they can't leave the facility. The answer is yes, you do. You have to pay for all hours being worked. And you may even have to then factor in some overtime obligation for your non-exempt employees who are continuing to work when they don't leave the facility. That doesn't mean that somebody who is required or a group of individuals who can't leave the facility, but they're there and you're showing a movie or you're having some voluntary, entertainment or break-related activity and they're not performing any work, then there is a greater question as to whether you actually have to pay them for their time there. But if they're performing services, if they're continuing to work at the facility later than you expected or wanted because of some natural disaster, you do have to pay them for the work performed. Under very limited circumstances, can you have somebody be a quote-unquote volunteer? You should assume that from a private sector standpoint, there is no such thing as a volunteer who is performing services for the benefit of your company. So there are a lot of questions that come up with those kinds of issues, hurricanes, natural disasters. It is really important to at least be sensitive to the obligations that your company may have, particularly when it comes to wage and hour requirements. We move now to the Government Now segment of this episode, and I want to give you two pretty important updates, I think. The first is dealing with the EEO-1 reports that many of your companies are required to do on an annual basis. You may remember last year the EEOC expanded its efforts to get certain pay-related data by finalizing a rule that expanded the EEO-1 forms. In addition to the demographic data that always had to be provided, now companies would have to provide certain wage data and certain hours information. Well, just before this past Labor Day, ironically enough, the Office of Management and Budget advised the EEOC that it was delaying the implementation of this new rule due to complaints that it had received about it being very burdensome, very costly, and not really that effective in accomplishing its goals. So the new expanded EEO-1 has been postponed indefinitely so that the OMB can review the various requirements in conjunction with the various burdens that may be imposed on companies. So in that regard, there is no wage and hour information that is due in 2017. And similarly, the March 2018 deadline for EEO-1 reports will only require the usual demographic information. And we'll keep you posted on what happens with this expanded EEO-1 concept to involve wage and hour information. But for the moment, that portion of the new rule has been postponed indefinitely. However, a different form that will be required going forward as planned is something worth noting, and that is the new I-9 form. As most of you, I assume, know, the I-9 form is used to verify employment eligibility, and it's published by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, the USCIS. Beginning on September 18th, 2017, that is September 18th, 2017, employers must start using that new form for new hires when you're talking about employment eligibility. You do not have to redo all of your existing employees, but for those going forward starting on September 18th, you must use the new I-9 form. So make sure that your HR departments and anyone else who is involved with the employment eligibility requirement at your company, make sure they understand what the new requirements are, what the changes are, and are equipped with the new I-9 form. Well, we move now to our special guest segment. And this today involves another hot area in employment law dealing with meal and rest breaks. No state out there seems to have as treacherous a scheme as California. So for those of you who are listening, and when you have California employees or you're thinking about having California employees, even if your business's headquarters is not in California, and even if you don't have an office, but you have or are going to have employees working out of a home office in California, it's critical to listen to the information that we're about to give you. But even if you don't have any kind of California obligations, I think this is also going to be helpful for you to make you a little more sensitive if you weren't already to this issue of meal and rest break requirements. And make sure that you know what's going on in your particular jurisdiction because, again, many states, many local jurisdictions have adopted requirements when it comes to meal and rest breaks that your employees may be entitled to. So joining me today is my partner here at Cozen O'Connor, Jason Barsanti. Jason is a resident out in California, and he practices primarily in Southern California out there in our offices. His practice involves labor and employment litigation and counseling, really in all industries, with a particular emphasis on complying with state, local, and federal wage and hour laws. So I welcome Jason to give us a few minutes of his time to talk about this very important issue involving meal and rest breaks. Hey, Jason, thanks so much for taking the time out and doing this with me.
Hey, Mike, anytime. Happy to do it.
So we're using California as an example when we're talking about meal and rest breaks, because California, I think, has some of the more robust and strict requirements when it comes to meal and rest breaks. Does the California law only apply to employers that are located in California, or does it also apply to those companies that have any employees working in California, whether at a company office or at home?
No, it applies to any employee who is located in California. So if a company has a location with a single employee, it could be in an office, that person is covered as long as they're a non-exempt employee. Or if they have remote employees who just happen, they live in California, they work remotely, they would be covered as well. And California has a very strong public policy of protecting its citizen employees. And so our courts and our legislature definitely take a wide reach as far as to whom these laws like meal and rest break requirements apply. And as you pointed out, to say that California has some of the most robust, I have never run into any state with more robust or strict meal and rest break requirements. I think we are definitely one of 50.
Yeah, and is that sort of a policy statement from the legislature there in California? I mean, why is that?
That's a good question. I like to say that California regulates virtually every part of the employment relationship, and that includes meal and rest. It includes going further on overtime, on calculation of the regular rate, on paid sick leave. You know, we could do a lot of these podcasts on a lot of differences in California law, and I think it is just a strong policy that our legislature has adopted of being very protective to employees, and which causes a lot of problems for employers. But if employers are on the ball and they keep these in mind and make sure to stay up to date on them, we can certainly be in compliance with the various nuances of California law.
Yeah, and there's no question. I mean, we can devote a separate whole podcast just on California labor and employment law. But let's talk a little bit about the California version, at least, of these meal and rest breaks. And let's start with the meal breaks. When, under California law, are meal breaks necessary? How long must they be? Give us a sense of what the rule is when it comes to meal breaks.
So California has very specific requirements for meal breaks. The first is that employees are entitled to a 30-minute duty-free and uninterrupted meal break for every 5 hours worked. We'll treat that as the baseline rule. And then there are some little nuances to that. So let me just walk through that. That means that if an employee works less than 5 hours, they are not legally entitled to a meal break. However, if they work five or more hours, they are entitled to at least one 30-minute duty-free uninterrupted break. However, if they work more than five but less than six, the employee can elect to waive that meal break. It is best to have that waiver in writing, fully apprising the employee of their rights and responsibilities under the law, and also apprising that employee of their right to revoke that waiver at any time, and the revocation need not be in writing. In fact, it's a very bad idea, I think, to require that to be in writing and to not allow an employee to be free to revoke. So let me give you an example there. If an employee clocks in at 12 noon and the employee works past 5 p.m., that employee must be given the opportunity to take their 30-minute duty-free uninterrupted meal break, and that meal break has to start on or before the five-hour mark. So by the end of the fifth hour of work, it has to start. So in a short answer, a long answer to a short question would be that 30 minutes for every 5 hours, and it has to start at a specific time, which is by the end of the fifth hour. So that's the first part of my answer. The second part would be when an employee works longer than 6 hours, now the meal isn't waivable. And if they work more than 10, now we're into a situation where an employee is entitled to a second meal period. So once we hit that 10-hour mark, Now, the second meal period must be given unless the employee waives it, and that waiver is only good if the employee works fewer than 12 hours. The duration is the same, 30 minutes, and the starting point is the same idea. That meal break, the second meal break, has to start by the end of the 10th hour in that situation.
And these are definitely, I mean, these are clearly strict rules and all of that. Does it matter how many employees the company either has generally or how many employees the company has in California specifically?
No. These requirements are California-wide, and they are for any non-exempt employee working in California.
So you could have one employee, you could have a company that has 10 or 1,000 of its employees in other states, it could have one employee in California, and these rules would apply to that employee.
That's right. You could have a single remote employee working out of their home who is a non-exempt employee, and not only do these requirements apply to that person, but the onus of making sure that these requirements are met are on the employer, who may be all the way across the country.
Okay. And I'm sorry, I probably cut you off with that fabulous question that I had. Is there anything else about meal breaks before we move on to the other kind of breaks that you wanted to add?
Yeah, there were a couple things that I wanted to mention. The first one is that when we're counting for the 5 hours, the 6, the 10, the 12, for whether a meal break is required or waivable, we count the rest breaks, because rest breaks, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a second, are working time, and they're on the clock, and they're paid time, so we count that. But we don't count the first meal break to find out if the second one is required, because meal breaks, being 30 minutes or more, are off the clock. They are the employee's time to do with whatever the employee sees fit. So there's a little bit of a calculation nuance there of what time we're counting to determine if we give an employee the opportunity to take a first or second meal break or not.
Okay. And so let's talk about, because you just mentioned it, so it was a great segue, let's talk separately about rules regarding rest breaks to the extent that they may be different than a meal break. So same questions. When are rest breaks necessary under California law? How long must they be? And, you know, what should employers look for there?
So the language that the California legislature, as well as what we have here in California, is we have our California Labor Code, but we also have wage orders, which are these industry-specific items that are issued by our version of the Department of Labor here in California. That is where most of our rest break requirements come from. The language they use is that an employee is entitled to one 10-minute net uninterrupted and duty-free rest break for every 4 hours worked or major fraction thereof. And long story short, major fraction thereof in California is 2 hours. What that means is that once an employee hits 3.5 hours, they're entitled to their first rest break, okay? Because 3.5 is the cutoff for getting a first rest break. After that, every 2 hours past 4, you get a rest break. So let me give you the chart that we like to talk about here. It's 3.5 gets you one rest break, 6 gets you 2 rest breaks, 10 gets you 3 rest breaks, and so on. You could keep adding 4 hours and another rest break all on down the line.
And this is an industry specific again, or whether you're doing manual labor or office labor, this applies across the board?
That applies across the board. In addition to that, because that wasn't enough, those breaks, now, we're not as specific as we were with meals. Remember that meals had to absolutely, bottom line, start by the end of the 5th or the end of the 10th hour.
Right.
With respect to rest breaks, they have to start as close to the middle of the work period as possible. So what we take that to mean is that the first 4 hour work period, there should be a rest break around the second hour. The second one, like we said, if someone works more than 6, let's say they work an 8 hour day, they should get another rest break about halfway through that 4 hour period. So there should be a rest break around the 6th hour of work there. And we can continue that again for however many rest breaks are required. The only other thing that we should keep in mind, and employers should keep in mind, is that rest breaks are paid time because they are short. They are mandatory under California law. They have to be paid and they can be on the clock. So that, and because of that, they count for calculating things like, have we hit 8 hours for the daily overtime? Have we hit 40 hours for the weekly overtime, et cetera?
Okay. And so when we're talking about, and maybe there is or there isn't a distinction here for meal versus rest breaks, but can employers restrict employees from leaving the premises during whichever break they're taking?
Well, there might be a distinction. And let me break those into two things and I'll explain. Meal breaks, no. Employers cannot restrict their employees' movement during their 30-minute uninterrupted duty-free break. That 30 minutes is the employees to use as they see fit for their own purposes. Rest breaks, it is not as clear. For a long time here in California, it was understood that employers could restrict their employees' movement because it was paid time on the clock. So it belonged essentially to the employer. Last year, we saw a case come out of the California Supreme Court that shed some darkness on that. It was a case involving security guards where they were required to carry a beeper and respond to calls if something happened during their rest period. The Supreme Court didn't like that and didn't allow it, finding for the employee. There's language in that case that can cut both ways. So what we're seeing is a lot of plaintiff side lawyers bring rest break cases based on policies that prohibit employees from leaving the premises. I think there's a good legal argument against it. However, unless employers want to be at the vanguard of this issue and want to end up the ones to decide it with their legal fees, I think they should err on the side of caution, frankly, and not have a policy that restricts employees from moving and leaving the premises. I think, honestly, it's probably the best course of action is to allow the practical realities of a 10-minute break to do that for them. Because, look, you can go anywhere you want as long as you can get there and back and be done with your break in 10 minutes, right? Which puts some practical limitations on it. But I think a policy that does the same thing may very well run afoul of the law. And either way, it's going to cost a lot of money, even if it gets vindicated.
And sort of the flip side of that, if you're not talking about them leaving the premises, you have the employees who are still on premises. But, and I get this question all the time, and you can answer this either California unique or generally with your thoughts, but you get those companies that come to you and say, my employee wants to have lunch at his or her desk so that they can still answer a phone or, you know, continue doing some work that they weren't able to get to, but they're eating lunch. You see a problem with that, and what do you tend to tell companies about that?
Yeah, I mean, your specific hypothetical, I see several problems because what the employer there would be saying is they want to eat at their desk so they can continue to work, which means that you as the employer, when this relationship goes awry and a lawsuit is filed, that's going to be couched as the employer forced the employee to be in a situation where they had to work, right? That's the way that happens. From my perspective, the best policy is to remove the employee or dictate that the employee, you know, go to the break room or certainly not work at all during their break, because as we all know, an employee at their desk is going to get email, they're going to do work, and later on they're going to claim that they were forced to do that or coerced in some way and the employer knew about it and so they weren't getting their proper rest or meal breaks. And you know, the one thing that I haven't gotten into is what happens if you don't give these meal and rest breaks. And California does have a system of penalties that apply when we don't give employees the opportunity to take these breaks properly.
Got it. Okay. And so we talked about waiver just a little bit, and it comes to play in the situation we just talked about where they're eating a meal or, you know, taking the break still at their desk. Can these requirements, whether meal breaks or rest breaks, be waived voluntarily by an employee who wants to do so, either through an individualized agreement or through a collective bargaining agreement when we're dealing with a union?
So let me divide those into two. Let me first just deal with the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement side of it. There are some specific provisions in some of the industry-specific wage orders that allow employees that are members of unions to collectively bargain to change the requirements of meal periods. The one example I can think of off the top of my head is that manufacturing industry employees can bargain to start their meal break at the end of the sixth hour, or by the end of the sixth hour rather than the fifth. So there's a good example of it. And there are others. It pays to know which wage order applies to your industry and what's possible within them, because while the wage orders are about 92% the same from industry to industry, it's the 8% that the devil's really in the details.
That's a great point.
As far as individual waiver, we talked earlier about if someone works between 5 and 6, they can waive, and between 10 and 12, they can waive. So there's that. The way the law is couched here in California, an employer is required to give the employee the opportunity to take the break. So if the employee has the opportunity and they don't take it, it's not necessarily a violation. However, practically speaking, the best case for an employee, the best policy for an employer is to mandate these breaks, because when you don't, you're creating records, especially with respect to meal breaks, that on their face may violate the law. And now you are in a lawsuit that is a he said, she said type of lawsuit, which anywhere else might not be tremendously damaging, but in California it almost certainly will be, because here the penalties for missing a meal or a rest break are an hour of pay at the regular rate, which can add up. Those taking that penalty then gives rise to other penalties, at least arguably, like inaccurate wage statements, waiting time penalties for failure to pay wages at termination, penalties for failure to pay wages during employment, in addition to penalties under our Private Attorney General Act. When you add all that up and you factor in our four-year statute of limitations on meal and rest penalty pay, a policy that does not require meal periods, coupled with records that do not show that they're being taken for 30 minutes at the right times, is a recipe to spend a lot of money in litigation and very potentially to spend a lot of money in settlements or judgments at the end of that litigation. So,
that's the practical part of this.
Absolutely. So my recommendation is always, look, you know, the law says the opportunity, but you are better off. You're better off not stepping over a quarter to pick up a dime here. You're better off requiring them, mandating them, and making sure that people are taking their breaks at the right time for the right amount of time, and that they're not being interrupted.
Yeah, and the trouble always is, and you know, pick your law that you're talking about. You, from an employer standpoint, you're trying to strike that balance between not being too George Orwellian and you know, Big Brother in the workplace, and come down too hard and hurt morale. On the other hand, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, which was, I thought, a great point, it's all well and good when the employees are happy and they're glad to take their breaks at the desk, but when the relationship ends for whatever the reason, there's still is that statute of limitations that allows them to come back and bring a claim against the company. So, you know, you're almost damned if you do, damned if you don't in some respects.
That's right. And, you know, I tell people at the beginning of every seminar I give on California wage and hour law, I started off by reminding them that I didn't write these laws, but that I can help you. If I understand your business and what you're trying to accomplish, I can certainly help you comply with them, and we can get to 100% compliance. But that every happy employee in 5 years or 10 years or what have you is a potential disgruntled employee. You never know who's going to turn around and sue you because they become unhappy by that family that is their employer-employee relationship, that they spend, you know, half of their waking life with these people. So it is the best way to go about business to have these policies in place and enforce them so that when it happens and when someone turns around and wants to sue you, you are not the low-hanging fruit in the California legal system.
Do the meal and the rest break rules in California apply equally to both exempt and non-exempt employees?
No, at this point, they are only applicable to non-exempt, so hourly or salary non-exempt employees, fortunately.
Okay, so I mean, we can obviously spend you know, countless hours talking about whether someone is properly classified as exempt or non-exempt, and we'll save that for a different episode. But the point is, at least under California statutory scheme, it's only non-exempt employees that you have to worry about when it comes to these break rules.
That's right, and that, believe me, that's enough to worry about. But yes, we take solace in what we can, and that is that these are only applicable to our non-exempt employees.
That's true. And so I just want to, and again, I really appreciate you spending some time here. Just a couple of last things, really moving to the more practical part of what we've been talking about. You've been dealing with these issues for a while, both on the counseling side as well as on the litigation side. Are you seeing a lot of room for trip-ups by employers that have actually led to lawsuits that you know, you've been seeing out there?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, I'm sure that there is a wage and hour lawsuit out there in California that does not include a meal and rest break claim. I just can't remember seeing it. And I've seen a lot of them, including years ago, I clerked with a court, and we probably had over 100 of them that I saw, and I don't recall one of them having lacking a meal and rest break. So to say that this is a ubiquitous claim would not be an understatement at all.
Okay. And regardless of whether we're even talking at this point about the California specific requirements or whether we're talking about meal rest break issues in other states, are there any best practices that you can suggest to employers when it comes to meal and rest breaks given to employees under whatever the particular statutory scheme is?
Absolutely. And I could give you a lot of them, but let me give you two. And they're related. Number one, you need to understand the law, the regulations in your state, in your locality, et cetera. The best way to do that is really to consult with somebody who practices wage and hour law, especially in California where the stakes are the highest. But that's the most important thing. If you don't understand the law, there's no way here in California especially, but in most places, that you can hope to comply with it. The second one is related to knowing the law. It is to have a strong compliance plan in place. And I break compliance plans into three prongs. The first, have solid policies in writing, updated regularly, and clearly communicated. Two, documented training of management and employees. Because I can't count how many times I've seen a group of policies, but when you talk to people, they're not aware of them. They haven't been trained on them. They were never sat down when they were hired or promoted to a management role regarding those, and I think that's a huge mistake. And I think number three, just as important, all employers should have a compliance audit program in place, even if it's a yearly program, where they go through some kind of audit process to make sure that their systems are set up properly, that their policies are still in compliance with the law, and that they are being effectively, efficiently, and properly administered at the management, at the rubber hits the road level. By doing that, you can really avoid one litigation altogether, but you can certainly avoid litigation that goes back a long time. If you find you have a problem, it can be rectified before it gets out of hand.
And interestingly, you mentioned having a training aspect to this. California, we know, and maybe some of the listeners don't know, California tends to have also a unique requirement when it comes to HR training, right?
Yeah, that's true. And it couldn't be more important in California that your HR professionals, as well as your frontline supervisors, all know the law, know your policies inside and out with respect to meal and rest, but really everything, so that you can be in compliance. And so you can point to these. And again, the key here is to not be low-hanging fruit. Don't be the easy target for wage and hour lawyers, because the easy target here is definitely going to get hit. So always complying with those requirements of education and training with respect to wage and hour issues.
Well, this has been really helpful, Jason. It's certainly always good talking with you, and I'm happy to work with you here at Cozen O'Connor. So thanks for taking a few minutes and help educate us on some California requirements.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I enjoyed it.
That was really great stuff. Happy that Jason was able to share his thoughts with us, and I hope you found that to be useful, whether you have California operations or not, and meal and rest breaks were just something you hadn't really thought about involving any of your office locations. That's all the time we have for today. As always, thank you so much for giving me some of your time and listening to the podcast. I hope it's been useful to you. And until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.